Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, it's your old pal Wilson, and we're bringing you the 12 Days of Richmas. Yeah, we went there. I'm sorry about that. These are the 12 most listened to episodes of 2023. Enjoy.
Insane in the Membrane.
Hello and welcome to another edition of your favourite podcast, Insane in the Membrane, with your old pal Wilson. And this week, I'm joined by the mighty Paul Foote. Hello.
Hello, Rich. Nice to be on the show.
It's nice to have you. I apologise for mucking you around. My brain, it's like a boiled radish, my brain.
It was like a nightmare.
Oh,
it was like, I thought it was supposed to be 3 o'clock and then it was 5 o'clock. And I felt like I was living in, it was like living in a, like I was living in some sort of film, but not in a good way, just in a really, really disturbing kind of, what time is it starting kind of way.
And it's just one of those things that just, it's like, we get to five and it's like, oh no, it's seven. Oh yeah, but no, it's nine. And it just comes.
It's like the film Sliding Doors, except it making no difference one way or the other. It doesn't really affect anything. So it's a bit like that.
You could have gone either way and it would have just led you to this point. And that's it. Nothing else. Oh dear me. Can you hear me all right, Paul?
Oh, I can hear you very well. I just wouldn't say anything because I just I just zoned out a bit there. Your voice was so... I can hear you, but your voice was so relaxing. I started to just completely go into a soporific state. It was sort of hypnotic trance, you know.
It's now become a sleep story. You're going to be asleep by the end of this. And you're feeling sleepy.
Oh, yeah.
Drowsy. Your eyes are slowly closing. Do you know what, Paul? I'm actually, and have been for many years, a connoisseur. I've been on your mailing list for a long time.
Oh, that's good. Yes, I'm glad. Just because people who are listening don't know, I have my own society, the Guild of Paul Foote Connoisseurs. And it's, yes, a good society.
Yes.
It's very nice.
It's very
Lots
good.
Lots of nice people there, like you. And they're all people who like my comedy. But I always say they're connoisseurs, not fans, because they're not fans. They don't like standing around with a notebook asking me to sign something. They just like the comedy.
Yeah, we appreciate good comedy, which yours is.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to stand in the street corner, would you, Rich, with a piece of paper trying to get me to sign something? You wouldn't bother.
Maybe. I don't know, Paul. I don't know where you live. Maybe if I found out where you lived, maybe that would change it. Maybe this is what this is all about. This is a cunning plan just to find out where you live so I can get you to sign my book.
You might be able to find out where I live from this image, because you're in my private boudoir, really, because normally I do my podcasts from another room in the house, but today, because my boiler's broken, I'm doing it in the kitchen, which is the only warm place. And it's got all my things up, my little things that I've... Just various things over the years I've stuck up, little memories of little things everywhere.
just to keep you happy, just little things on the fridge.
Yes. Well, there's an invitation to a wedding. Oh, yeah, do you know? I hadn't seen that for ages. That was an invitation to a wedding anniversary party. But on the day of the wedding anniversary party, I couldn't find any of the details. Or, like, where is it? And I knew they'd sent something to me in the post. Well, there it is. It's been put there on the fridge. So I often put things on the fridge and forget about them. And then yes, I'll put that on the fridge, I think. Very important invitation to a special show business party. And I forget about it.
But I do that. I looked in my diary yesterday to see what was happening today. And I just felt I was so ahead of the game. And all it was that I got the numbers jumbled up and just, and it all just fell apart.
Did it say 1,500 and you can think of that as five?
It said 1,500. And I think somewhere along the line in my head, I went, oh yeah, so we'll be done 4:30. Then Paul and I will chat five. So I'll be, and then so five was in my head.
Yes, well, I think it's understandable. It's an easy mistake to make. And obviously, if I wanted to be very judgmental, then I could say it was highly unprofessional and you should always check and double check these things. And I could say it's about time you got used to the 24-hour clock. It's not complicated. Check and double check. Is it in the 24-hour clock? Or does it say AM or PM? It's not difficult. Well, that's what I would say if I was done. I could work as a check-in for Ryanair or something because I could do that. And then I could say, you're 2 hours too late. It's all on the terms and conditions. It's not my problem. And then they could say, yeah, but we're going to have to stay in a hotel now. We won't go. The holiday's ruined. I say, it's not my problem. Terms and conditions.
Is that it? Yeah, terms and conditions, that's it. Gets you out of everything. Have you ever had a job like that? Have you ever worked anywhere, Paul? Because I don't imagine where you would work. I've only ever known you as Paul Foot, comedian.
Well, I've only known myself as that. I have barely ever worked.
Yeah.
I've never done any job in customer services. What I mean is most people have done a job in a shop or they've done a job being a waiter or something. I've never done anything like that. I've only had... Well, there was like a sort of work experience thing when I was 18. I don't think you could even count that as a job.
Right, where was this?
That was in Madrid after I left school, and it was reinsuring light aircraft and putting it. It's like I had to enter all this data into the computer about how much the aircraft were worth and how much the people were being insured for in the event of death or serious injury. It was quite sort of boring, really, but because it was in Spanish, and my Spanish wasn't that brilliant, it made it kind of quite interesting. It was quite challenging because it's in Spanish. So I did that, and then I did one thing, which was like some weird thing. It was like a work experience thing for 2 days, and it was in the city of London, and I mostly just kind of photocopied stuff and had to wear a suit, and that was just for 2 days. And then I did get a job because I obviously wanted to be a comedian and I needed some money when I started. So I applied for various jobs. And then I only really went to two or three interviews, but one of the first ones I went to was with this recruitment agency. And they actually didn't want to employ me. They wanted to place me.
Right.
I went there and it was very boring. It was an administration role. And then I remember talking to Julian, who was interviewing me, who's since become a very good friend.
Mm.
And I said, oh, I'm very interested in administration. Administration is what I love admin. I'm really interested in it. I could see his eyes glazing over as I made up all this rubbish. And then I said, look, actually, I'm not really interested in this job at all, but I want to be a stand-up comedian and I need some money in the meantime. And his eyes lit up. A, because I was telling the truth, which is always more interesting to hear from someone. And B, because that's the sort of man he was. He sort of like loved the idea of it. And then he then said, well, there could be a better job for me in other opportunities that he sort of advised me about. But after about 3 months, he rang me and said, have you got a job? And I said, no. And he said, we'll have to employ you then. And then so I went to work there and I was there for... I did 9 to 5, 5 days a week for 3 full months.
Oh, but wow.
Then I had enough, I had enough of 9 to 5, 5 days a week. So then I went to flexi hours after 3 months. And I stayed in the job for 18 months. One time he said to me, he said, a good job you work here, Paul, because you're completely unemployable. Because I didn't like being given orders. I like to do my own thing.
Yes.
And I just like to go in and work out what I was going to do.
Right.
But I actually did invent some computer systems for the company that I think are still there now. Like some of the things I set up still.
Really?
The sort of the foundations of it. And I also just made up other things. Like sometimes I was just out going to buy a cake so everyone can have cake and that.
Yeah.
I just go and buy a cake, you know. But I used to think, this is good. It paid me like an hour to go out, get the cake and come back. And I think, I just earned so much money, you know, because in those days, one would think about the amount of hours and you think, I've got that much money, you know, whatever it was, £10, whatever it was at the time, or half, I can't remember what it was, £15, I can't remember. But anyway, you'd think, oh, and sometimes doing a job, well, that's the only job I did, but you'd sort of think, oh, it took 20 minutes to make that phone call, I've just earned £4.50. That's £4.50,
right, I've got. Yeah.
That's sort of what would get you through the day, really. And in the end, I did some drilling, which I was not in any way equipped for, and I drilled a hole through the door and, like, broke the door slightly. So then I was kind of about to turn professional as a comedian anyway.
Mm.
So I said, I won't charge for my time today. And if that we still argue about it, whenever we meet up for meals a couple of times a year and have a nice meal together, he maintains that I was sacked, but I maintain I resigned. We're not quite clear on it. The one thing we are clear on is that I left under difficult circumstances. So that was the only job I ever did.
Oh my God. I like, do you know, speaking of cake, I still, and it was only last week I was talking to my wife and we got cake and I told her about your bit where,
yes,
you see, when someone makes a cake and gives you a bit, see how long it takes. You see how long you can go without saying the word moist.
Well, not long. That's
not
the
long.
Whole point of that piece of comedy.
Yeah.
That piece of comedy is, it's interesting, isn't it, when one looks back on one's career. Not that I've finished.
No.
but I have, in the sense that I've got to this point, so everything is before. That's
yes.
The only way it can work. It can't time travel. But when you look back, you sort of think, certain things just captured the imagination. That cake thing was one of the things. And,
yeah.
You know, sometimes, particularly in Australia, I don't get it so much in the UK, but in Australia, people come up and say, oh, you didn't do your cake thing tonight. And they really, I mean, they loved it in Britain, the cake thing.
Yes.
But they really, really went for it in Australia. And then
really?
The Shire Horse thing was a big thing over here and in Australia as well, both really.
Yeah. So you were saying before that you had an issue with people telling you what to do. Like giving you've like, so has that always been an issue with you when you were growing up?
I think I always had a rebellious streak in me. There was something about being told what to do by the teachers, which I didn't mind being told what to do if it was a sensible thing to do.
Mm.
But sometimes I just sort of thought, well, what they're telling me to do is not sensible, it's not the best way of doing it. You know, there's a better way of learning this, or. And I sort of, in a way, so then I would find it difficult to just follow the instructions. So I was only subtly rebellious at school. I never went to detention. I was never in trouble, nothing like that.
No.
But then I was never made a prefect or anything like that because I was considered too kind of wild, too kind of unpredictable to be made a prefect. Not conformative enough, conventional enough to be a prefect.
But this is what I like about you, is the fact that you are unconventional. But what I really like about that is that it's not, you don't go out of your way to be that. It's like some people, I know some people that would love to see themselves as eccentric and weird and wonderful, but you are You are you. And I love
well,
that.
They say, yeah. I mean, they say, don't they, that if you try to be eccentric, you're not being eccentric.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Same as you can't try to be original. You either are original or yeah. you're not.
That's a great point. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was worried about that. I think about that the other week. I was just looking at, I hate watching myself. And now we have to put out clips of our stuff for social media. I struggle with watching myself to be able to do that. And I was thinking about, oh, no, this is all bollocks. This is unoriginal. It's exactly what I said. And then you kind of just got to just keep working at it, haven't you? And give your clips to someone else to sort out if you can't do it yourself.
Yes. But I suppose if you don't like what you see when you see yourself, that's because you have a certain picture of how you are.
Yeah.
And a certain attachment to a certain rich Wilson.
Yeah, I think so. I don't realise how blokey I come across. I was watching something and I just, because loads of people say it all the time, oh, you're just a lovable geezer. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm not really like that. And then I see myself and I hear myself like, well, I am that. So what am I hearing in my head? Because I'm hardly walking around like I'm, I don't know. I don't know what I think. I don't know what my brain thinks I am.
Yes. The Duchess of Parma. That's what I was thinking you don't sound like.
That's what my brain thinks I am. I think that's what it is. I walk around like I'm Quentin Crisp, but in the body of Ray Winston.
Well, of course, this happens to people as they get older, doesn't it? Because obviously, as you get older, you sort of still feel the same. You're still in the same body, looking out the same eyes.
Yeah.
And that's why a lot of people don't like the aging, because it's sort of because it's suddenly a very physical manifestation of the fact they are actually getting older, and the fact that 22-year-olds aren't interested anymore. You know, and you sort of think, oh, why aren't they? Because you feel like the same inside. And then you get home and think, oh, that's why. Because I look really old.
You should be talking to 22-year-olds. Look at the state of you. Oh, God. Although there are some people that I know and I've had to speak to and say, listen, come on, you shouldn't be talking. You shouldn't be worried about 22-year-olds now. Come on, come away. come over here with the grown-ups now.
What, you mean friends of yours?
Friends of mine, yes. That still, you know, they still see themselves as these gadabouts. They see themselves as these, you know, these, they're still like, you know, these hip boys about town. You're like, you're 53. You really shouldn't. Put some socks on. Come on. Come away.
Yes. I mean, I talk to people of all sorts of different ages because of my job, I suppose, so I meet audience. Yes, so, you know, one meets people all ages. But yes, the days when one imagines that a 22-year-old is in some way interested are in the past.
are you still taking pictures of people's haircuts? I remember when I first met you and I had like more of an Oasis kind of mod haircut, and you took a picture of that.
Well, I can't remember. Perhaps that was a little phase I went through, taking people's haircuts.
Yeah. No, it was nice. I enjoyed it. I very much enjoyed it. Where did you grow up, Paul? I can't quite place you. Where are you from?
I grew up in Buckinghamshire.
Yeah.
Which is where I still live around here. So, near High Wycombe, that sort of area.
Oh, I know, yeah.
Not in High Wycombe itself, which is not the most exciting place, but near, in that area. So, I've always lived around here. I like it because a lot of people, obviously, comedians know, because comedians go all over the country, but a lot of people don't know about it. They say, oh, is that Berkshire? Oh, is that Hertfordshire? They don't even know where Buckinghamshire is. And then you say it's between London and Oxford, about halfway between.
That's
they still
right.
don't know. When you explain about the Tube and Zone 9, they just literally have no idea what you mean by Zone 9.
Yeah, it's Zone 9. because we only know as much as far as 6. That's as far as we go. But Zone 9, yeah. I mean, that's it could be out of space.
It's quite fun sometimes seeing, you know, occasionally if it's a Friday or Saturday night, and I'm on the last train home, and someone has maybe had a few wines at some office function and they've fallen asleep on the train, they get to Amersham and then they say, oh, overslept sort of thing. And they say, oh, when's the night bus? And you say, well, there isn't the night bus. Well, when's the next tube back into London? Well, in about 3 weeks, you know. I mean, there isn't one.
This is it now.
You're in Amersham.
It's like when I used to live in Southend. And the end of the line was Shoeburyness. And the cab drivers down in Shoeburyness used to be millionaires of all the people that would fall asleep on the train and then have to get a cab back. Absolute fortunes they made. And so, I know. It's always nice to live at the end of the line, especially if you like a few wines.
Yeah, so I live at the end of the line, or not actually at the end. I have to drive 6 miles beyond the end of the line.
Right.
It's no wines to me.
And did you, because like I just said, you've never tried to be anything other than yourself. Whereas when I was growing up, I kind of trusted the adults. I was like, oh, well, the adults know best. It's only now I'm an adult myself. I'm like, no, they had no idea what they were doing. I wish I'd have said something. And like you just said, it's like, you know, you just knew that grown-ups would ask you to do things and there was a better way of doing them. You had the wherewithal to question it. You know, you weren't being a difficult person. You were just like, no, that doesn't seem right. Has that always been an issue for you? Just because you've always been yourself, especially growing up in a place like High Wycombe. Were there issues growing up?
Well, I don't have much of a relationship with the past. I remember it much, really. I remember school being... I remember it being difficult because I was bullied.
Mm.
And all these things at the time, you know, when you're looking back on it, it all seems... Like, I remember there was one particular person who used to bully me at school. And then... And it was terrible, really.
Yeah.
And if one went through puberty like a year later than the other boys, this was some nightmare. Who cares, you know, in the scheme of life? Why is it so important? But at the time, this was terrible, you know.
Yes.
Like a nightmare. And I remember all of this bullying and stuff. And then I remember that when I was at university, so we were all about 19, and he wasn't at the same university, but I think he must have come to visit someone who was there. And so, and I was all scared. Oh, my God, it's him who's bullying me. But then he was 19 or 20 years old by then, and he was just perfectly pleasant and nice and just grown up and nice to see you. And you sort of think, oh, that was just not... You know, on the one hand, it was sort of like it wasn't really real. But it was real, but it was like... That wasn't him. It was just how he was as he was growing up. He felt the need to sort of bully. But on the other hand, I thought, that's like 4 years of my life you made misery.
Yeah.
So there was a slight resentment at the time.
But that's it. I mean, a couple of years ago, I saw one of the guys who used to bully me from where I grew up in the town. He never didn't go to my school, but when we used to hang around in this park, I remember... seeing him turn up and I would just be filled with dread and he'd do all sorts of horrible things to me. And then I saw him putting petrol in his car a couple of years ago. And bearing in mind, that was like 30 odd years ago. And I felt the fear. And then I was like, I'm going to go and say something to him. And I'm like, he won't know who you are. And it was a really weird moment that it was, you know, he probably would be fine and he wouldn't even remember. And it's strange, isn't it?
You never did it. You never went to him and spoke.
No, I never went. Should I have done? I don't know. Well, it wouldn't have achieved anything, would it? It would have just been odd.
And I think also then when I went to university, to my shame, I think I was a group of people who was not very nice to some other people.
Yeah.
Not bullying like at school, but... not physical bullying or anything.
No.
But I think because I met some other people at university and I think they'd all been bullied, we were all the ones who never really went to the parties when we were in school, and we were not very cool, and we were bullied and all that stuff. And so then we discovered, okay, we're adults now, we're at university, and we all kind of, so a group of us all got together as friends, and we were, I think, so relieved and excited that we were, we'd found friends, we had people who were, and all that stuff. And then, but then I think then there were some people who weren't in our little group, and we were only 18 years old or 19 at the time, but there were people who were not in our group. And then we were a bit nasty to them, a bit like, you're not in our group, not very welcoming, not very friendly.
Yeah.
Because we were so desperate to be, yeah, we're in this group, but we weren't secure. We weren't secure in that. It was the first time that we'd been in a group, so we weren't secure enough to just be, well, because I didn't want to be nice to the people who were not as cool as us, in inverted commas, in case that meant that the other people would say, well, you're not in our group anymore, and then I wouldn't be in your group. And we all probably felt the same, so we were all insecure.
Yeah.
And it meant we were not very nice to other people. I mean, obviously, we grew out of that. But it is an example, isn't it, of how people get bullied and then maybe themselves are not very nice to others.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Especially, I've said this on here before, the school that I went to, it was an all-boys school. So it just went down the line. Like, somebody was getting bullied, so they bullied you. You'd bully somebody else. Everybody was bullying somebody to make you feel better because you were getting picked on. It's horrible.
Well, mine was the same. All-boys school, very similar sort of thing, you know.
And, so, oh, God. And if you, like, you talk about puberty... Now, when you look back, and having spoken, having my lads that have grown up and gone through it, and having spoken to other young people, it's very different now. Whereas it was so toxic when I was a kid, there wasn't any understanding. It was kind of, again, you were just bullying each other, like, because somebody hadn't quite got to where you are puberty wise, so they were still, when it was no hairs or they hadn't quite grown. Or whatever was going on, or, you know, questioning people's sexuality. It's awful.
Well, yes.
It was awful.
Yes, sexuality. I mean, there were 1,100 boys in school, and none of them was even concealed gay, let alone openly gay.
Right.
It was very just, that's not what you do.
Yeah.
Things changed quite quickly, I think, after I left. I think a new headmaster came in who was much less patrician, and I think just the zeitgeist changed.
Yes.
I mean, that was 1992 when I left school, and just things changed in the 90s, and it was just like much less of a big issue.
I think that's it, yeah. It was a big issue when I was a kid. I left school in 88, and so, you know, the 80s, I started secondary school in 81. And so it was, if you showed any signs that you were anything other than heterosexual, your life would be awful. And I remember there was these lads were doing this thing. They were giving each other love bites. And I made some comment going, I can't exactly remember what I said, but I know it wasn't very nice. And then they kind of rallied, they sort of turned on me and were like, oh, well, we'll see you after school. And I'm like, well, yeah, but you can't do anything. You're kissing each other. And I think about that all the time. And I think about how horrible it was that I said those things.
Well, that you said those things.
Yeah. For some reason, because I don't even know why I thought it was an issue. Because I don't have an issue with it. I just haven't. And my mum and dad were very progressive when I was growing up. So I was surrounded by all manner of diversity. And so to be in that environment and for me to be taking the piss out of two lads for giving each other love bites, I don't know where it came from. I don't know if I was trying to impress my friends or hiding something myself. I don't really know. But I know it was horrible, and I know it's made me feel shit ever since.
Well, they do say, or, you know, that, well, I don't know whether they say, but I say it anyway, In fact, I did a piece of comedy about it a few years ago.
Mm.
Like, no one, the nastiest people in the world, no one could be crueler or nastier than children in a way.
Yeah.
They can be so horrible to each other.
I think that's it. And it's only, I do remember at the time, because I remember one of the lads, we ended up in a back and forth, and then him and his friends said they were going to meet me after school. And I sort of went, I went a different way. And then I was walking up the road another night with my friends, and he was on his own. And I went over to him and I was like, all right then, come on then, you want to meet me? Being all big because my friends were there. And I remember him, he goes, no, I don't want to. And then I don't want to either. But because of all the other lads, we were kind of getting pushed into this thing. And I've spoken to him since. Well, I've met him. So I'm still friends with other people that we know. And we've both said, you know, we were pushed into a thing we didn't want to be in because of the environment. But at that moment when we were face to face, and he said, and he had the guts to say, I don't want to. And I was like, yeah, I don't want to either. And I think that was the turning point. That was the time I was like, yeah, I don't want to be any of this. I don't want to be this fighting laddie sort of thing. It was a real moment in 1988, that was. Yeah. But it still bothered me. I don't know. It's just because I'm not, like I say, I've since had experiences with men, and you know, it's, so I don't know what my issue was.
Well, I think the issue was the same with me when I was at university. That there's a lot of baggage, or certainly it was then, about being gay. You know, it was just considered just a out and out bad thing. You know, just
yeah.
I mean, when I think back on it, I think there were 1,100 boys. And they never once taught us anything about sexuality or anything.
No.
And I suppose the reason would have been that the headmaster and the teachers and the general zeitgeist was it was just considered a kind of a problem, something you have to deal with, maybe.
Yeah.
It wasn't considered, that would be just something completely normal. No one once said to me, you know, if you're gay, that's completely normal. Who cares? Or even if you're just bisexual, or you feel that you want to, you know, who cares?
Yeah.
Like, so now, it's, you know, when I speak to, you know, young people and students and things, I think it's just a totally different world in which it's not even an issue. The idea of having to come out to something is just irrelevant.
Yes.
Not everyone, but a lot of people, the default position is to see themselves as bisexual and just whatever, you know, no one cares. It's not a thing.
Yeah.
The idea of having to sit down and say to people, I am gay or I am bisexual, implies there's something bad about it, doesn't it?
Yes. It's like an extra thing that you have to warn people of or explain to people of. And now, you know, I'm glad it is where it is, because obviously it's so obvious, you know, your sexuality affects nothing, doesn't affect anything, you know.
And I think, you know, and things have moved on so much. I mean, religion plays a role. And just when I was at university, I had what we would now call mental health problems. I had depression and there were things I was dealing with. Nowadays, people would say, well, you know, that's okay, and you need some help and some people to counsel you and work out what it is. Whereas in those days, it was very much, well, you've got to sort yourself out or you'll be expelled from the university.
Oh, wow.
And I went to see, not a vicar, but I can't remember the name, like a chaplain of the this college. There was a chaplain. And he said, and I said, oh, I'm gay, I'm dealing with that. And I said, I'm depressed about various things. And he said, I remember this, he said, well, you know, I've encountered people before, there was someone else who had all these issues. He was gay and he had depression and stuff, and you know, and he did kind of kill himself. So
that's
sort of understandable that it was very much implied that perhaps the best thing would be. It wasn't quite like that, but it was kind of implied that if I were to commit suicide, that would be a quite understandable.
They
reaction.
Would have understood. Oh my word!
And that was, but that's religion, isn't it?
Yeah,
that was the way he saw it as basically being a sin, and he saw my sexuality as irreconcilable with what he would have considered to be proper moral living.
Yeah. And all it is, and as we've already said, your sexuality is irrelevant. It makes no difference to anyone or anything. Yet you, because of the environment we were growing up in, which, like, as you said, thankfully seems to have changed vastly. The fact that you really shouldn't have had to deal with anything. There wasn't anything to deal with.
No. But a lot of this, I think, because it all comes to, of course, you say that it's not an issue, it's not a problem, but it is a problem, though, if you believe that it's a sin, and if you believe that committing a sin is a very serious business. You
know, yeah.
If you believe all that, I maintain that my theory is that so much of Western morality, particularly about sexuality and things, it all comes from St. Paul. Not really from Jesus.
Right.
Jesus never said anything about being gay or anything. I think he just said, love everyone, save your neighbour and all this stuff. But it was St. Paul who wrote all those letters to, you know, the Corinthians and all, whoever these letters were for. And a lot of, I think he's sort of very undernoted as a massive part of Western morality.
Oh,
all
really?
All comes from those letters. Stuff he says about sexuality, about women and all these things. So it's very patriarchal. It's very patrician.
Yeah.
So all comes from St. Paul, all these things.
I had no idea. Because I haven't really studied it, to be honest. Because it's never really... all I ever see is religion causes more problems than it cures. And I've never really... So I just see it as that. So I've never really studied it. So I didn't know that. I just assumed...
Yeah, well, I might be wrong. And there might be people who are theologists who... say, actually, it's a bit more complicated than that and so on. But I always think so much of that comes from those letters.
Yeah.
All that stuff about sexuality, a lot of that sexuality stuff comes from those letters.
But the irony is that probably, if that's the case in those letters that St. Paul had written, he was probably hiding so many things himself. He was probably gay. He was probably all of these things. And he was trying to deflect...
I know. Obviously, he said it all came from God. It was from God who told him all this stuff, or it was somehow.
Yeah.
But it was not... Jesus never taught that stuff. He taught it, and it's now in the Bible, and the Bible is the Word of God, apparently.
Which
so
is the...
everything he said is apparently the Word of God.
So that would be the... Would that be the New Testament?
The New Testament.
Yeah.
Some of it, I think, also goes to the Old Testament. That stuff about man should not lie with man or something. I think that's Old Testament.
Right.
There's more stuff. If there wasn't enough anger and bile in the Old Testament, St. Paul came up with some extras for the New Testament in the form of a series of letters.
My God. Like he had...
voices and letters.
I wonder if he was from Tunbridge Wells, disgusted from Tunbridge Wells, or disgruntled, or whatever it used to be, on Points of View.
Well, he was kind of like that. He's got disgusted off Damascus from St. Paul.
But it's bollocks, isn't it? And all these people, especially in America, you get these big, you know, the TV evangelists, and they're the ones ripping everybody off, taking all their money, telling everybody it's a sin to be gay, it's a sin for two men to be this, two women to be that, and then the and then, but they're the ones behind closed doors
Of course they are.
Doing the very things they're saying are a sin.
I think you get that also in other religions, for the people who are the ones who are supposed to be the ones that give all the moralities and stuff.
Yeah.
They go out of their own country and do all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
Which they would never allow the people to do, and then they come back and enforce it all and tell people what they're supposed to do.
Well, I was reading somewhere, I won't say which religion it is, but there was, like many religions, they have high walls around where they live so that their God can't see in. And so they get up to all sorts. And you just, it's just human beings manipulating the teachers of these spiritual beings, yeah, whatever they are.
It's slightly ridiculous, isn't it? One would almost be tempted to say it doesn't sound very rational or sensible or logical or anything.
No. How did you feel about religion? I mean, you had the wherewithal, and I'm so blown away by this, to question the adults when you were a child. How you must have looked at religion and gone, none of this makes sense. This is all.
It took longer. I was brought up in sort of Church of England.
Mm.
My mother was Catholic, but sort of I would go to. I didn't really go to the church much. So there wasn't a time in my early 20s when I went to church, and I kind of believed it. And then as I thought about it, I just thought, this is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. And if anyone listening and you are religious, that's up to you. I'm not saying that you shouldn't. You can believe whatever you believe. It's just the people that manipulate others for their own gain.
And I think also... I think on another level, there is a lot of beautiful writing in, say, the Bible or other religious texts and things that, you know, incredible religious and spiritual allegories that can teach us things, and there's all sorts of wonderful stuff there. But so I'm not just dismissing it all as just all rubbish.
No.
It's nothing at all we can learn. But I would not want to be part of, say, the Church of England, because ultimately I would be part of a regressive organisation. And when you think of all of the things, all of the freedoms, the fact that homosexuality is no longer illegal, which it was up until the 70s, the fact that we can now have gay marriage is equality. Yeah. And all sorts of other things. The fact that we now say that if people want to change their gender or be gender or not have it be gender fluid or whatever they want to do, that's all right. All of those hard fought freedoms have been despite religion.
Yeah.
Religion, every stage has been pulling it back. I mean, the Catholics are even more extreme than the Church of England.
Yes.
But let's not pretend the Church of England is in any way progressive.
No.
I mean, they're still arguing about... I think they have now said women can be bishops, but there was all this stuff about, for ages, women couldn't be bishops. Well, it's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, it's just ludicrous. I mean, it's so misogynistic and patriarchal.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't want to be part of such an organisation because it is, to me, they have, you know, held back things for years and years. Mm. The less powerful those organisations are, I think, the better society is.
I think so. But you,
I don't think it's in somehow underpin morality or something. I don't believe that.
But that's what's happening in America, isn't it? It's now we feel we are... They are regressing over there, going back to, you know, the word of God and it's ludicrous and it's a shame because the world is such a beautiful place with such beautiful things in it, and if we're allowed to just be ourselves, we create some wonderful things.
As you say, in America, it's going backwards. has done, women's rights and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
Gay rights. So it's, you know, one has to keep fighting for these freedoms, because this, I think, has been a complacency in a certain sort of liberal circles of this particular liberal Western democracy and other Western democracies, this sense that things are always just sort of becoming more liberal and everything's just sort of improving. But not necessarily. We have to watch out for that.
Oh, most definitely. But you have found your tribe with the connoisseurs.
Yes.
And that's...
And, yeah.
But have you found it... Because you're going on tour now. Or you're on tour now. Are you on tour yet?
I'm on tour, yeah.
You're on
I'm
tour now. So that must be a nice... That must be a nice place to be, because you're doing shows now for people that have bought tickets specifically to come and see you. It's whereas a comedy club where you're on a mixed bill with whoever is a little bit more unpredictable.
Well, yes, it's the other day I was doing the Glee Club in Birmingham.
Yeah.
I think it's an unusual. I don't think there's any other venue like it. There might be another one. I can't think of it, but it's unusual in that I'm playing one of the rooms, which is the Studio Theatre, and meanwhile there's a club going on in the other room.
Yeah.
It's not very often you get that. And I sort of popped into the dressing room to say hello to the other acts, and it's all very friendly. But it did absolutely, in some ways, bring back those memories. Just even just walking through this room of people who were sitting there for the club and thinking, oh, that would have been me. And now we welcome our next act. Paul Foot, and you have to, some of them are really, some of the clubs are lovely, of course.
Yeah.
But some of them, and I'm not saying anything about the Glee Club in Birmingham, that may well be a really lovely club now. But certainly there were clubs where, immediately they wouldn't, it would be combative. Certainly me, with my eccentricities, they would often sort of think, who's this? I don't know, we don't like him, who's that?
Yeah.
And you'd immediately be on the back foot, even from the moment you came on stage, they'd be like, oh, we don't like you, what are you doing? And it was just frightening. So, yeah it's such a... if you left a pause too long, or if you had... You might have gone on really well, but you had one joke 15 minutes in that didn't work so well, then there'd be someone who would immediately heckle because they were waiting for that little chink, that moment when you weren't quite to... So, yeah, it brought back those memories, and I thought how it reminded me how privileged I am to be, on with an audience who's come to see me, who give me the space and time to perform and to take people on a journey with ups and downs and some quieter bits and still high laugh count that you can... But you can give people moments when they're not laughing and they're thinking about things and achieve all sorts of things you couldn't achieve very easily in a club.
Yeah.
So, yes, very lucky.
But I find you, and I'm not just saying this because you sat here, it's performers like you who I find inspiring. And I'm not just saying that. It's because you are so yourself and brave enough to be yourself. I'm too busy worrying about what other people think of me. I want people to like me, and I'm scared that if I'm just myself, they won't like it. So I'm like, what do you want? What can I do for you? What can I be? Whereas you're you, and I love that. And watching you do, you were doing mime, but it was because sometimes you didn't think the mimes might not be very good. So it was mime plus.
Mime plus, so it was mime with speaking.
Yeah, and then explaining what you just acted out. And I was watching it and I'm going, how are you getting away with this? And it was brilliant. And I'll just sit there going, fuck, I just don't have that courage.
Well, I don't know how I got it really, but I think I did lots of clubs for many, many years, and I somehow managed to not really let the clubs affect me and how I wanted to be. But I still had a respect for the audience. So I wasn't just couldn't care less.
No.
Just go on, who cares? Somehow I managed to get some sort of balance. It was tricky. But there was often, there was a conflict. Because I would go on at one show and I'd think, do you know, it would go really well. Some of the clubs were great. I had a great time. And then I'd think, do you know, I could have pushed it a bit further. I could have been a bit more out there with the choice of comedy that I'd done that night. And I think I wasn't quite satisfied. I could have pushed it further. Mm. But then another night, I'd push it a bit further and it wouldn't go so well. And maybe I'd try and get it back, but it was too late. And then I'd think, do you know, I could have really got more laughs there if I'd played it safer. So there was always, or often there was this conflict, which doesn't exist now in the touring with my own audience. Yes. There is no conflict. I just do what I want to do and they want to hear it.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how I did it. And the clubs were very different to how they are now. I think now, certainly there's lots and lots of clubs that are very are great, which I do sometimes play, which are where they actually want something really weird and interesting. I've played a few of those recently where the, if you were to go on and do something conventional, they'd be like, what's this, you know?
Yes.
But that didn't exist 25 years ago when I started. It was all very much they wanted a conventional thing.
Yeah.
And there was no real place for what I was doing and what some other people also doing.
But this, like you said, I'm glad that these places exist now. And what's nice is that they've given me a chance to explore some things I wouldn't normally do. There's a gig called ACMS that I've done. And every time I do it, I always make a point of doing something that I would never normally have the courage to do. And I had this one bit and I had a cat mask and I was going to go on with this cat mask and go on and on and on and on about how much I love dogs. And then halfway through realize I've put the wrong mask on. And I'd build it all up and I'd made sure, I was like, yeah, this is going to be really funny, really funny. And I got to the gig and there was a guy wearing a giraffe mask. And I was like, how am I hack already? And it completely threw me. And I had to kind of do this rant about being hack in an alternative comedy night by turning up in an animal mask, which... it's kind of like route one.
I don't know whether that is hacking, just unlocked. Yeah. I was also had a mask. I mean, sometimes, you know, like you can get comedy nights in some of the sort of trendier comedy nights, for want of a better word, where you get several acts will all use a projector, and they've all got a laptop.
Yes,
and they're doing projecting. Where, you know, 10 years ago, you'd have thought, oh, my God, someone else has got a projector, they're doing that. Nowadays, no one cares, you know. It's just like, yeah, there's going to be three acts and they're all using a projector. In the same way that years ago, I might have thought, oh, there's a gay comedian on and I'm coming on after and I'm talking about my sexuality for a bit. Oh, dear. Whereas I've done nights... where there's been five gay comedians on. It's no one cares. It's just not even an issue anymore. It's just, to give a very extreme example, in 1997 or 96 when I started, it was the received wisdom in virtually every comedy club that you'd... I mean, I can't even believe I'm saying this, but this is what it was like, that you'd only ever have one woman on. You'd have a woman on. You wouldn't ever have two... because that would be too much for the audience, you know. Because, women, they can't really hack it and all these stupid things people say. I mean, just the idea of that now is obviously ludicrous.
Absolutely.
How much things have changed in the last 26 years.
Yeah, it was the same when I started. I remember as a barman. I was in 2001, I became a barman at a comedy club. And then I became a comedian in 2004. And, even back then, it was still one woman. She'd be on in the middle. They would only have one person of colour on. They would only have one gay comedian on because they didn't want to confuse people. And you're like, what are you talking about?
No. Did we do a gig together in Banbury?
We did. Recently.
Because you did a thing about... you did a thing about trends being transgender or about attitudes towards transgender people.
Yes.
And then you... And, of course, it was... Because the audience perhaps wasn't necessarily expecting a middle-aged white man to be saying... They were expecting you going to say something like, it's not how it used to be, is it? Yeah, yeah. I remember when it was all like that. And so they weren't expecting it slightly. And it was... a reminder to everyone that it's not just the young people who are talking about these progressive issues in a progressive way.
Yes.
But and I also remember that some of them were like, yeah, we agree with you, Rich, because your joke, I can't remember what the joke was, but it was basically making fun of people who are transphobic and have an issue. That's basically what it was.
That's it, yeah.
And some people were like, yeah, we agree with you, Rich, but there was a bit of a silent minority was not so. That was a sign of the danger to come because I came on stage, you introduced me, and it was great, it was great fun. But there were a few people in there who perhaps, you know, and I think I actually, there was someone who actually then walked out halfway through because I don't know what they were eating there, and he was absolutely just didn't laugh and he was all upset, didn't like it. And then I heard from the very nice person who ran the place. He was a big fan of mine afterwards. So he was saying it in a nice way to me because he was a, he loved my comedy. But he said that person left and said, I don't want to sit and watch that a gay on stage. I don't want to hear a gay person. Not that even what I was doing was anything to do with being gay.
No, not at all.
It was mentioned a couple of times within the context of a couple of jokes, but most of my comedy was just about other stuff.
Yeah.
But anyway, who cares? I could do what I want. But anyway, he just didn't like that. That was a reminder that, there's danger in this
place. Yeah. There is still work to be done. You're right. And but that makes me want to keep doing it. I want to keep doing material like that about more progressive stuff, talking about the issues that are out there because it's the only way we're going to make changes. I remember there's a gig that I book and I booked all women and it's only a couple of times a year, this gig. And I got a thing back going, it's all women. And I'm like, yeah, but that's not why I've booked them. They're all brilliant. This is going to be a good night. And it was a good night. But if I'd have gone, oh, actually, yeah, you're probably right, and changed the lineup, then we don't make any progress, do we? We don't.
Well, yes. So it's the other thing that occurs to me is just it reminds me of a review I got in from Edinburgh with my show, because in my show I talk about near the beginning of my new show Dissolve, I talk about change, and I'm basically talking about how ridiculous it is that people are just stuck in the mud against change, you know.
Yeah.
But I loved how the reviewer just said Paul Foote comes on stage in the early stages of the show and does a rant about change, but not in the way that you expect a middle-aged white man to do. It's similar to you, you know, when you were doing something, you know. People just think, I find that sort of comedy really boring, the idea of him saying, well, I mean, maybe we should do a bit together now. Maybe we should do a bit of a nostalgia.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not like how things were in the 80s, is it? In the 90s. In those days, we all knew where we were then. It wasn't all like that anymore, is it?
A man was a man and a woman was a woman and there wasn't. You knew where you stood. It's just.
And I find the idea of, obviously I'm aging and I'll get older and older. But I really don't want to be one of those people who gets older. And it can happen, of course, in your 70s or 80s. But as we know, it can happen in your 40s or even 30s. So even comedians in their like in their 30s or certainly in their 40s, moaning on them, oh, this isn't working to me, and going on about, it's just so boring.
Yeah.
And I remember in our day, we didn't have a mobile phone like this. People weren't on their phones all the time. So what? Who cares? People use their phones more. They're using apps, you know.
Yeah.
So what? You know, sometimes people aren't talking to each other at the dinner table because they're on their phones, but they'll talk to each other at another time.
Yeah.
Things have evolved. Things have changed. They have. You know, people will still, all the same things will still, as long as we don't destroy our planet to the point where hardly anyone can live here, and there's, obviously we're not all going to, the human race isn't in peril as such, but the size of it might
yes.
be some terrible thing. But as long as that, you know, as long as we somehow manage to still live here, there'll still be people, and they'll still have sex with each other and make babies, and there'll still be people talk to each other and have conversations, and people will still be kind to each other, and it's not all going to fall apart. I just find that idea of, oh, it's not how it was, and people have lost their sense of community, and all. It's just boring.
Yeah, it's all there. It's all still there, and it will still be there. And I've really enjoyed talking to you, Paul Foot. This has been such a joy, and thank you for being patient. I do apologise for ruining your afternoon, early evening, making your tea late.
Right.
I do apologise.
I can have my supper now in a minute.
Lovely.
Get that oven on.
Are you on social media?
I am, yes.
Where can we find you on the social media?
Well, I'm on... it's a good question, isn't it? On Instagram, it's Paul Foot Comedy. And on Twitter, it's Paul Foot.
Lovely.
And on Facebook, it's something or other, isn't it? it's got to be something, isn't it? I mean, I've got to be on there.
I'm sure you are.
It's Paul Foot, you know, Paul Foot on Paul Foot, you know, with a little tick. You know you've got found me. Got a tick, and I've also got a website which people can find by going to http://www.internet.com, and you go on the internet and you go on the internet.
Oh god.
And you find me at paulfoot.tv is the website, but people can find it.
And that's where we can find your...
On Google. And I was going to say other search engines are available, but they're not, though, are they? There aren't any.
Not good ones. No one's looking
not
for...
Really.
No one's looking for Paul Foot on Ask Jeeves, are they? Or Bing or whatever.
Yeah, I looked up Ask Jeeves a while ago. I thought, what's happened to it? And it's sort of... it got bought up by... I don't know, 15 years ago by Google or something.
Google just took over the world. That was it. So, Paul, you're on tour, and we go to your website, and there we can see where your dates are.
Yes.
And we can get tickets to see you on tour. Paul Foot, this has been a joy. Thank you so much for joining me today. This has been Insane in the Membrane. I've been Rich Wilson. This has been Paul Foot. And we'll see you next time.
Insane in the Membrane.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Made by darkhorsedigital.co.uk. Shooting, live streaming, and podcast production.